I'm particularly delighted to release today's episode. In October, we held the inaugural Money Maze Allocators Summit, and over the 2 days, there was fantastic discussion, debate, insights, disagreement, and a lot of learning. But of all the conversations, one that particularly resonated with me was the chance to interview Sir Chris Hone about those two topics with which he is fantastically acquainted, investing and philanthropy. And I think, as you will discover in a minute, that he perhaps stands above most mortals with the clarity of his thinking and the extraordinary generosity and effectiveness in both disciplines. Thank you. I have had the pleasure of interviewing Sir Chris Hone twice before, and we are really, really appreciative of you being here today. Thank you so much. I think your investment success is probably only matched by your philanthropic generosity, and we're going to talk about both of those today, investing and philanthropy. And I'm conscious, a little bit like an earlier panel with Tom Burley, I'd really like a couple of hours, but unfortunately that isn't possible. So will you come back next year? Chris, what's made you successful?
Well, and thanks for inviting me, Simon. Well, investing is all about risk and return, and the vast majority of investors focus on return. That's what you see in any asset allocator. What's your returns? Yeah, that's the only thing. But I focused actually in my career in on risk firstly. You know, return does matter, but to me, risk was always the first thing that mattered. And a lot of people have their own definitions of risk. I love George Soros's definition, which was not knowing what you're doing. So what does that mean? You know, for me, that's understanding what matters in investing. And there was a spiritual master once, he said, very few things matter and most things don't matter at all. And that could also apply to investing. So what does matter? Competition matters, because too much competition erodes your profits and maybe don't make any money at all. So I hate competition. And makes predictability and valuation impossible. And the interesting thing, so to me, in a sense, competition and disruption are the whole thing. It's not about growth, because you can have a first mover advantage, grow for a period, and then a new technology or a new competitor kills you off. And the fact of the matter is that most investors underestimate the forces of competition and disruption, because they underestimate complexity, they look short-term, and so we do two things, really. We're looking for such companies and with such high barriers to entry over the long term that we think we can have a reasonable idea that they'll be around. Okay, can't be precise about exactly what they'll be worth, but they'll be there in, not in 1, 2, or 3 years, which is the normal time horizon of an investor, but in 20 or 30 years, which is the time horizon where the value, if you do an MPV model, really is. We try to get focus all our time on barriers to entry and disruption, and and the second component of the philosophy, if you like, is long-termism. Now that's fundamental. You know, our average holding period of a stock in our portfolio is 8 years. We've held stocks for 13 years. And 12 and 10, but the average is 8 years. which is like starting to get into private equity land of duration of investment, and it's counting, 8 years and counting. Now, you may... but it's an interesting question. You know, a lot of people make money with high-frequency trading. The shorter the trading the horizon, the better. The average stock holding period is under a year of a stock in the US. So it's all very well to say you're long-term, but that's only a good thing. It's not necessarily a good thing unless it works. And it only works if you're right. On the first point about the quality and of the company and the barriers to entry. But if you're right, that you find a company that is going to be a good company long-term, then you should hold on to it, because there's a persistency of these barriers to entry and the things that make it good. So in simple terms, good companies stay good and bad companies stay bad. But and I guess there's another point. There aren't that many great companies, the super companies of the world, and if you find them, you should hold on to them. So that's and then there's related concepts like engagement and concentration, but those are secondary to the first points.
So let me ask you about those barriers to entry, because how has your thinking in identifying them changed in the last two decades?
Mm-hmm. We've enlarged the universe over time of things that we have found that are more companies, more industries, as we've learned. Like everyone, we're always learning. If you I always liked hard assets, infrastructure. What came within that, you know, could expand beyond. We've owned a lot of airports and toll roads, but, you know, we found toll roads in Europe, then we found toll roads in Canada and the US through Ferrovial and cell phone towers and railroads, and so but then beyond hard assets, infrastructure, we found other barriers to entry, such as network effects. Okay, and there's certain industries, payments is one. We've been a shareholder of Visa a long time, where it has this huge, ever-growing network connecting every customer and every bank to the world. And as the network grows, it becomes just ever harder to replicate. Aerospace is a sector that we've come to learn about and understand, and where the barriers to entry are multiple. Often you would like not just one barrier to entry, but maybe five. Intellectual property, you could have its brands, hard assets, contracts, network effects. We're big shoulders in aircraft engines, where you have many of those. IP, contracts, installed base is another barrier to entry, where customers can't switch, regulatory switching costs. We've expanded, you know, rating agencies is another one. So one of the key sort of points of if you really do find one of these super companies that can dominate their industries, they have something special, which is pricing power, which is a rare thing. So most companies don't like to talk about it. And it's a special thing because it means you can grow more than your volume, and it's got a leveraged effect. Because if it's above inflation, So pricing power means you can price above inflation. Then you, there's no cost to that. And if you have a 10% margin, it might give, you know, a huge, every 1 point of real pricing power is massive. it's a super leveraged and potent. And so but I think you the world is changing so much that some of these moats, apparent moats, are being just beaten down by AI and other disruption forces. So the forces of disruption, I would say, are actually rising.
So that was what I wanted to get to. Disruption is around us. Mm. You know, you got access to, you know, all sorts of very clever people, great conversations. But how do you think about identifying those underlying weaknesses that may derail the thesis?
Mm-hmm. Well, you really want something that's obvious. Warren Buffett used to talk about this. If you can't put it on, and when it's not obvious, you probably just leave it alone because it's probably not sustainable. So it's sustainable barriers to entry. So if we own an airport, it's pretty obvious we own a company that owns all the airports in Spain. We've owned it for a decade. I was on the board. No one's ever going to rebuild those and overbuild you, and 75% is unregulated. So when you look at it, the shops and, you know, so the infrastructure piece is, especially if you get it unregulated, toll roads where you have 100-year duration or 60 years, like Ferrovial, those are, you know, people, we don't know whether people are going to drive electric cars or which brand of electric car, or, but it's pretty clear they're going to need these roads. And so those are obvious things. I'd say when you have multiple of these barriers to entry and no alternative option, so we like aircraft engines, but will there be an alternative technology? Yeah. Will they become electric? The science doesn't really permit that. And it's too expensive to replace the existing fleet. So you've probably got a pretty good visibility on 25 years. And so think technologies that change quickly aren't good for us. Can't predict them. So I would say some principles would be multiple barriers to entry, and and essential need. Yep, something that is essential. So you've got to be confident of the need. So are people still going to want to fly? You know, we believe that's a durable need. You know, so we don't like discretionary things. You know, I've never been an investor in the handbag business. Lots of people have, and they've made lots of money in it, but I've never, you know, understood what makes one handbag better than another. or why it's essential. So anyway, it may well be. I don't need to understand everything. Yeah, it just stay within your sphere of competence. That's what Buffett said.
But we have this. What is fabulous about the investing business is it's the quantitative meets the qualitative. And you've written a lot about engaging with management. Mm. And I wonder, when you go to meet managements today, you've done this for a long time, what are you thinking about that conversation?
People think, read about us and they say, oh, you're an activist. Well, we've done that. It's sort of a tool, but we prefer always to have constructive long-term relationships with management. And we hold an investor day in New York every year for our investors. And this year we had the CEO of GE Aerospace, the CEO of Airbus came to speak to our investors on the stage at the same time. Never been done before. CEO of Moody's, CEO of Vinci, top executive from Visa. So and every year we have the same thing. And these people come because they think we can add value to them. Our aerospace analyst was invited by GE's CEO then to speak to their top 300 managers about the company. So that's not normal. Why do they do that? Because they think we understand the company and we can add sometimes some value. They find it a value-added conversation. So because we do so much research on a company that... And we follow the industry, so we want to be a relationship, okay? And that means and it to be a conversation. Now, of course, we weren't always like that, but we've evolved, and so I'd say it really is engagement. Through engagement, you can learn something. If it's a one-way conversation, you're just speaking at someone, you don't learn anything. We have to learn.
But along your way, there will have been some investments that didn't work as well. And I wonder, when you reflected on those, was there something in those conversations that maybe you weren't as sensitive to that maybe you are today?
Well, ultimately, the quality of the business trumps everything. And so does management matter? You know, somewhat. Yep, it's not the key thing. And a great manager in a bad business, they can't really necessarily do much. And so, I think focusing on trying to assess management through conversation may miss the point. Okay, so. I think you may overstate the value of the management and sometimes management won't even necessarily understand their own pricing power and latent pricing power but I think it's something on the question. You've got to listen and see if you can learn and be humble. If you become arrogant, that's a killer in the investing business. Yeah, I've had.
I try not to say anything. So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. IFM Investors is a global asset manager, founded and owned by pension funds with capabilities in infrastructure equity and debt, private equity, private credit, and listed equities. They believe healthy returns depend on healthy economic, environmental, and social systems, and these are evolving on a scale never experienced before. To find opportunity, build value, and meet the needs of future generations, you need scale, skill, and expertise. That's what IFM Investors has built up over 30 years. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more, or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market.
Given
that there are stretched valuations in all sorts of parts of the world, you have been very comfortable shorting in the past. Sort of under what circumstances might you have more shorts than you've had of late?
You know, I've never really been a significant short seller. I don't think I've cumulatively made absolute money in it, and I sort of agree with what Warren Buffett told me one night. I had a dinner with him, and I asked him about shorting, and he said he didn't do it because he and Charlie Munger concluded it was just too hard. Too unpredictable. You know, he thought long and hard about it because in shorting you need to also understand investor psychology. Because when a short goes against you, you have to fund the losses. People think that's like a costless thing, but you have to sell longs to fund the losses on shorts. And you can eventually be right, but can you hold your position? You know, we did have a short a couple of years ago in Wirecard, where we thought it was a fraud, which is, we have a very high bar on, but, and actually apropos timing, I filed a public criminal complaint against the company in the Munich prosecutor's office. Of course, the company wasn't too happy. The chairman used to be the CFO of Deutsche Börse. He said I was a liar, but within 2 weeks it was bankrupt. Now, and then the media got involved and they went to Australia to meet a guy at Bronte Capital, who was one of the very first short sellers of Wirecard 20 years ago. And they said, the journalist said, congratulations. Yeah, it must be a big day for you. Yeah. But the stock had gone up 20x. And he said, I had to cover it after a year. I couldn't fund the losses. Yeah. So I wasn't here to see the day it went bankrupt. Yeah. I lost. So it's a very hard thing. And you could be squeezed if you watch the movie Dumb Money. It's a great movie. You'll see the difficulties of short selling, of being short squeezed. So there's so many technical issues that I, sometimes you just have to, experience tells you, it's just too unpredictable. And because of the investor psychology point, yeah.
So it's interesting. I see in the front row is Chris Dale of Kintbury Capital, who also successfully shorted Wirecard for a while, and right to the end, actually, as it happens, and I'm an investor with them, which is why I know. What are you most excited about when you think about the investing landscape?
I like things that will just compound long term. I don't change year to year very much, so things that I feel confident will be around in 30 years in a dominant position excite me because it's just predictable. I value predictability. Yeah, sometimes people, your very question illustrates what most investors are looking for, the next hot thing. Yeah. The new thing. And sometimes I'll say a little bit sarcastically, will you want to invest and say, what's new? I say, do you need to change your wife every year? Yeah. It can be a difficult conversation. Bronwyn always says, don't ask that question, because people might give them ideas. So,
what do you know, by the way, that I don't?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, well, you wouldn't ask that question because you're happy with it. Yeah, you're happy with what you've got. Yeah, it's not that easy to find. There's some truth in some of these funny examples. It's not that easy to find the right partner. It's not that easy to find the right investment. So, why do you want to change them immediately? If you find something good, it's going to be good long term, stick with it. And don't think that newer is always better. This is what investors think. They don't think about sustainability. They want the next hot thing. They think growth is the thing, but new is the thing. But that, we want to be, because so many people think in terms of what John Keynes or actually, Benjamin Graham said that in the short term, the market is a voting machine. What's hot? Yep, what's new? But in the long term, it's a weighing machine. Yep. So in the COVID, Peloton was hot. Yeah. Went to $50 billion valuation. Everyone was on their Peloton machine, but then it, virtually went to zero. So I think that's the most important question. Is just we're more interested in the question: what is what's going to be around, rather than what's new.
Very clearly expressed. Let's switch to philanthropy. Why?
Yeah. So Simon and I talked before, and you had a lot of questions on how. And I said, you know, there's a book, and the book title of the book is "Let's Start with Why."
Yep.
That's a better question to start with. And it was when I was 20, I went to the Philippines and saw people in poverty, and I thought, living on a garbage heap, and I thought, this isn't right. If I could do something one day, that would be a good thing to do. But then I didn't have any resources, and found my way to a hedge fund in New York. And after some years, I had a good year, and they paid me a bonus of $10 million. I had a couple of million dollars. I don't remember exactly, not lots of money. And I immediately gave it away to charity. I didn't want it. I gave up a foundation and put it into it. I didn't. And I couldn't tell you the reasoning. I just thought, this isn't really something I should have. Yeah. And then I started doing more and more. But I didn't understand it. For 20 years, I was doing philanthropy. Sounds strange to say. I remember sitting down with Bill Gates and him asking me the same question. And it was only in recent years I sort of figured it out, actually there's something within all of us. We'll call it consciousness. Some people call it the soul. Now, my son, I tried to explain this to him. He said to me, "Dad, the soul is a myth." And actually, I don't think so. But and it's this that drew me. It's the basic urge of the soul is to do service, and so that's, it's a soul-driven thing, and it's not of the intellect. It's of, I'll call it, higher mind or intuition. So that's the answer to the question. And also, it's a knowing, if you like.
So there'll be people in the room, small, large, donators to charity regularly. How do you prioritize?
I think there's two answers to it. One is, what is it? What do you feel passionate about? And then there's another more analytical answer, the intellectual. You know, there's intuition and intellect, two different ways of thinking. And the intellect, I look for high leverage and fundamental things. They are things that are what's most important. So one of the things I'm really passionate about is contraception in poor countries. Now, in Africa, where I do most of my work, the women on average will have nearly 7 children. Now, they don't want 7 children, just to be clear. It's not their choice. They don't own their bodies often, and for various reasons, usually economic, yep. But it's foundational, because if a woman, let's say, wants 2 children, not 7 children, and she's so poor she can't, feed or have health for those 7 children. If she has the 2 children instead of the 7, you see, everything is much easier. Yeah, it's sort of obvious stuff. And the other thing I'd look at is where there's it's unfunded or underfunded. Yeah. So, you know, the contraception is sort of seen as a controversial thing for some reason. In the Millennium Development Goals, nobody put a fertility target. That was deemed too controversial. They conflated it with coercion, which is stupid. And so I'm also interested in, you know, so for $10, you can, back to value for money, you can avoid avoided unwanted pregnancy. So the value for money is incredible. Other areas that I'm passionate about are very involved in climate change. It's foundational. It will undermine all of development as soils dry out, drought. Won't be a, people will have less to eat, you know, hunger, malnutrition, and it impacts the poorest first. Yeah. Country's already hot, getting hotter, and so climate is really also foundational and urgent. I'm also, there are other areas, I love neglected tropical diseases because the impact is enormous. About 7 diseases impacting 2 billion people, many of which people never heard about, like trachoma and river blindness and lymphatic filariasis and schistosomiasis. Anyway, these things can be eliminated. And the drug companies have actually funded for free the drugs. It just needs someone to do, you know, mass drug administration, which is very cheap. And so it's really a crime not to do this. And trachoma surgeries, these people go permanently blind for a $50 surgery. Yeah, isn't that crazy? So, but I also, there are other big things that are I care about that are foundational as well, like child marriage. That's a big thing. So, go ahead.
So it's a little bit like the top down and bottom up of our business. So when you identify that theme, terrific, but you have to choose a partner. How do you think about that?
Yeah, because what do I have? Just money. Yeah, money's a commodity, and so I have to work through people I guess we have 3 types of partners, governments, NGOs, and companies. And if you can do this through governments, it's perfect, as it's more sustainable. Okay, and so, and sometimes we'll do both. We'll fund NGOs to work through governments, because so what's an example? Messaging to women in Ethiopia married couples in Ethiopia through community health workers funded by government there, about the benefits of contraception. It's actually free. they already fund the community health worker. We found that 70% of the women who were, the couples who were messaged to about the financial cost, would you believe, of having, you know, lots of children, started taking contraceptives who weren't, and sustained it. So it's an incredible program. They've rolled it out through the country. And so we love, if we can, to work through governments, NGOs. Why NGOs? Well, where sometimes governments don't have the innovation, they don't have the or the interest. Okay, so child marriage in India is something where it's not something requires, if there's going to be, and often an NGO has to why do you need an NGO? It's an interesting question. Yeah, why can't you just tell government the idea? Well, sometimes governments don't care. Okay, why do we, yeah. Well, and so the NGO, you know, trying to stop child marriages, you could just end up being killed, yeah, in some of these places. Yeah, it's not for the faint-hearted. So it's not that they don't care, they're not willing to sort of put their life in danger. And so you often find NGOs care more. And so if, especially if you can pick the right leadership. So I do a lot with grassroots NGOs, but we're always trying to prove a concept and then get governments to scale it. So we did, and companies, I'll give you a couple of examples. There may, sometimes there's market failure. So a few years ago, 10 years ago, there was a company that patented therapeutic food for severe acute malnourished kids, a company called Nutriset, and these, which was a bogus patent because it wasn't novel. But they prevented other companies producing it to make money. And I funded a company to break that monopoly. In fact, I put in the contract that they were sued to cease and desist. They had to continue. I'd fund the litigation, but they couldn't stop. And the company was called Manny Nutrition. And I put $200 million into it. And now they have a capacity of $500 million. They've saved over 10 million lives. Okay. And but they're a non-profit. So they never made any money. CEO calls it an upside down company where their performance is measured in lives saved, not money. But why would other people, they say there's not enough money in it, yeah? Or there was someone trying to patent it. So there are all sorts of reasons, but the social payoff is enormous, yeah? So sometimes there's stuff that, philanthropy can be catalytic in a way which, so we'll use any partner that's intelligent, but you really want to find people who care. See, this is a strange thing to say, but, you know, my early days, I would ask, well, can you hire mercenaries? You know? People who just care about money. And I came to realize that it doesn't work. Yeah, you need people who it's from the heart.
Schroders is an international active asset manager working with institutions, intermediaries, and individuals around the world to create prosperity for them and their customers. Over two centuries, Schroders has given their clients the edge by seeing things differently. Schroders' active perspective combines rigorous research, innovative thinking, and deep market insight to help you see opportunities and risks in a new light. Whether building portfolio resilience, seeking return opportunities, generating income, or decarbonizing your portfolio, Schroders offers a heightened perspective to help you stay ahead. Leveraging their expert capabilities across public and private markets to help clients achieve investment goals. With Schroders, you get the active edge. Discover the active edge at Schroders.com. Remember, capital is at risk with investing. The Money Maze podcast is proudly sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, a global leader in financial markets infrastructure. LSEG has a rich history of facilitating capital flows, empowering businesses, and connecting investors to opportunities. Today, they provide world-class technology, data, and analytics, playing a critical role in shaping modern finance. From their role in sustainable investing to their contributions to financial innovation, LSEG is helping to build more connected and efficient markets. Visit LSEG.com via the link in the show notes to see how they're driving the future of finance. And so therefore, performance measurement
takes on a different perspective.
Yeah. Now, performance is an interesting question, okay? And because if you don't understand the theory of change, and the you can make a big mistake and by measuring the wrong thing. Now, especially back to the point, if you don't know what you're doing. So here's an example. For 10 years, I funded this company that did contraception for adolescents. Now, what's an adolescent? In some cases, they were children. And I was brought into a slum a couple of years ago to meet these girls, and I knew immediately something was very wrong because they were so depressed. And if you looked into their eyes, there was nothing behind the eyes. Psychologists would say that they were dissociated. Yeah, I would say it's soul disconnected. And I asked them, why do you need the contraceptives? They wouldn't answer the question. I said, so the KPI was, did they get the contraceptive? And on paper, it was all great. They all got these contraceptives, very low cost. And I asked the question, well, because they wouldn't answer, do you have boyfriends? They said, no. I said, do you have husbands? They said, no. And they were 15, 16, 17. I said, then why the hell do you need these contraceptives? And they said, because we're being raped all the time since we're aged 8. And then other girls told me they were having to prostitute themselves to eat. So suddenly, the performance indicator of did they get the contraceptive and what was the unit cost of the contraceptive was missing the point. These girls had to find a way out of their situation. Yeah. So you've got to understand the root cause and rather than just working on symptoms, because the KPI may not capture the quality of life. Yeah, where life isn't about just years. Yeah, those girls, as is the case for many women in these poor countries, they're living in hell. And so, but if you were just looking at numbers, you don't see it. And the only reason I saw it is through looking at them as human beings and saying something's wrong here. So, of course, we look at cost benefit, and but sometimes the and another key point is are we prevention versus cure. You know, if you can prevent, you know, there are just so many no-brainers, I call them. You can test someone with a saliva test or a rapid blood test for HIV and find a positive person, put them on treatment, $300. We've done 11 million tests with the Global Fund. So simple. So you stop that person spreading it to multiple other people for $300. Yeah. So but you've got to try to get to root cause. Why, and it's not always obvious or simple. Why are children being married off? Is it economics? Is it consciousness? It's actually, you do need to change consciousness.
Which, of course, leads to my last question, which is, you've given an example, your former example, I can't think how AI could help. The latter is that AI might help. How are you allowing it to help?
You know, everyone thinks AI is the be-all and end-all of humanity. Well, there is one problem with AI. It doesn't have consciousness or conscience. A friend of mine told me last week that a friend of hers, her daughter, was very depressed, and she was using ChatGPT to talk to. She's very isolated, and without going into the detail, she ended up committing suicide, and the AI didn't obviously do anything. Yeah. So we're as a species, we've confused intelligence with, you know, and knowledge, and you know, consciousness. And so, without, we think information and intelligence is the be all and end all, but there's something more powerful, which is love and heart and consciousness. And without that connection, and actually, people are becoming more disconnected from that. Always on their phones, always thinking that ChatGPT or the latest AI can give them the answer. Well, the you know, the becoming more and more in intellect, and so I think we have to actually we're sort of entering you know, a more and more dangerous point for humanity, because the we sort of have lost the plot, where we think that AI will solve all humanity's problems. You know, couldn't be clearer that problems are getting worse. Yeah, no solution for climate change, no solution for poverty, wars, you know, you name it. And inequality, divisiveness, hatred, it's all rising. And I think, you know, and so I think there needs to be a new paradigm in consciousness, and it's not about AI. It's about love. If you and there are foundational principles, yeah, that are rather disruptive, such as ownership. Do we owe, you know, this concept that we own things and that it's ours? And I've always thought, I actually don't own anything. I'm just a custodian. Yeah, what is that? Yeah, which is this money isn't mine. It's to be given away and in service to humanity. And if you go out of the intellect into intuition, yeah, which is why made me give away that money. You know, when we're on our deathbed, I don't think we think we own things. Yeah. And why would we? Because ultimately everything is a gift. It's not as it's, you know, I didn't, you know, make all this money because I was smart or lucky. It was, you know, I think because I'm willing to give it away. And so I think, you know, the most important thing, back to what matters, is consciousness and love. And if we connect to that, then we'll find purpose, yeah, so I think for me, in a nutshell, philanthropy has given me purpose.
What a great place to stop. So, Chris, you have given so much to the world, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.